WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good Friday morning, everybody. We have Richard Wolff standing by. You might know him from Olbermann and from his many appearances on this show talking about national politics. He's got a new book. We'll talk about his close coverage of the president, including the travels currently to Germany and yesterday Cairo. And our first guest today is watching the Obama administration unfold from very close up. Richard Wolff, MSNBC analyst and former Newsweek political correspondent, has a new book about the Obama campaign and the first 100 days, for which he got more than a dozen one-on-one interviews with the president. Word is they also play basketball together and are quite friendly in general. The book reveals all kinds of things about the campaign, like Obama knew he wanted Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State even before the campaign was over, and that he almost abandoned the slogan, "Yes, we can," before launching it because his speechwriter hated it. So we'll look back a little, and we'll talk about the president's current doings from the Cairo speech to the Sotomayor nomination and more with Richard Wolff, author now of Renegade, The Making of a President. And hi, Richard. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, thanks so much for having me back. It's great to be back with you, and people should stop procrastinating and contribute to WNYC.
Okay. You do the interview. I'm kidding. Let me thank you for that. Let me get your thoughts first on the day one impact of the Cairo speech. Truly a speech heard round the world. What would you say the response to it is looking like, and with what consequences for the president and his goals?
Well, this was a remarkable moment. Now, you can disagree with his policies in the Middle East, and frankly, there are going to be many people across the Muslim world, which extends well beyond the Middle East, who don't agree with his approach, but they were paying attention. There is this competition for something that we have discussed many times on this show, and everyone in foreign policy circles have, but for the hearts and minds of the Muslim world. And we saw it in bin Laden's tape, not just any old other tape, but telling Muslims around the world, don't believe this guy, Obama. You know, that's an important addition to the arsenal that the United States deploys. And here is a president who can speak uniquely and personally to these subjects. He obviously is marking a clear break with the Bush era. But I think it's that personal power that he brings to it. It's the ability to get people to pay attention at home and overseas, especially in this case overseas, that makes it really truly something we haven't seen. I just don't know what the precedent is. I would say we haven't seen it at all.
Well, when you ask what the precedent is, remember that during the Bush administration, Karen Hughes, his aide, was leading this whole outreach effort to the Muslim world. Do you think President Obama did more in one speech yesterday than Karen Hughes was able to do in 4 years?
I'm willing to go out on a limb and say you can't even put them in the same sentence. I mean, one thing is, and I don't blame Karen Hughes for this, but their approach was propaganda. You know, they call it public diplomacy, but it was coming up with posters and TV ads and that kind of thing. There is nothing like, for a start, people look at America differently when they see a president whose middle name is Hussein, and we're talking about people in the Middle East. People look at America differently when they see an African-American, because frankly, nobody ever thought that America, around the world, people didn't think America was capable of electing an African-American president, and maybe there were many people here who didn't either. So people are paying attention a different way. They're listening, they're tuning in, and when he talks about the contribution of of the Muslim world to Western civilization, whether it's architecture or algebra or the peaceful tenets of Islam. Now, President Bush used to talk about that, too.
I was just going to ask. So is it the message or is it just the messenger?
It's both. It's both. For someone to say, you know, I understand that Islam is peaceful, but also I am familiar with the call to prayer in the morning and the evening. It just has a credibility that wasn't there before.
And some of the media images today are very striking. The Washington Post, page one, has a big Indian Muslim family watching the speech together on a big pink bed in India. It's a very pink photo. The New York Post has hooded Hamas members watching him on their TV with guns on their laps. I recommend these two images to everyone as kind of a media studies lesson in contrast. And the audience for this speech, Richard, I guess it's fair to say, was that diverse.
And this is something that he brings a personal experience to, and it is something that has shaped his approach. And I explain this in the book. You know, for a start, we all have tended to think of Muslim opinion or the Muslim world as some sort of monolithic thing. And in fact, the diversity of Muslim thought of Muslims and who are Muslims is extraordinary. And Obama's experience of Muslim culture spans that diversity. In fact, in many ways, he's least experienced in the Muslim culture of the Middle East that we kind of narrowly focus on. His experience of Muslim life is Indonesia, a couple of years when he was a kid. But also, as I explain in the book, his best friends in college at Occidental in Los Angeles were Pakistani. And he traveled with those friends to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. That's why he calls it, actually. He has their pronunciation of Pakistan.
So maybe from a U.S. interest perspective, the question is, does it matter to, and I realize U.S. interest is not the only thing we should be concerned about, but does it matter to the United States if the family on the bed in India likes Obama, if Hamas and Al-Qaeda and Ahmadinejad still are out to attack us, or I'm not saying Iran is planning to attack us, but you know, all of if those threats are, if the people who are in charge of those threatening organizations are unmoved.
Number one, this is a global effort, so you need to have a global outreach. Number two, if you just engage with governments, then you can be fooling yourself. So reaching beyond the governments to public opinion is important. That's where the support comes from. And we are seeing impacts already. In Iran, the leadership has been befuddled by how to respond to the outreach from Obama. And when public opinion moves as well, for instance, in Pakistan, that's where the crucial support for Al-Qaeda is. So yes, it has an impact. Again, we don't know whether it's going to work, but it's another tool to deploy, another weapon to deploy, if you will. And to take it off the table certainly doesn't help America's national interest.
Richard Wolff, my guest on WNYC. You maybe watch him sometimes on Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. He's a political analyst for MSNBC, was with Newsweek, his new book, Renegade, The Making of a President. And in the book, you write that during the campaign, Obama stunned his aides by defending his promise to meet foreign leaders like Ahmadinejad without preconditions. What's the backstory there?
Well, you know, he sprung this on them in an early debate, an early TV debate in the primaries. And frankly, he wasn't a good debater. He didn't do his homework. He didn't prep. He didn't like debates. And he sprung this on them. And they were on a call the next day thinking to themselves out loud with him on the call, okay, how are we going to clean this up? How are we going to explain this, backtrack, redefine it? And halfway through this discussion, he pipes up and says, listen, guys, I meant what I said. I want to stick with this. This is what we have to do. We have to have a different foreign policy. Not talking to our enemies or people who are hostile is not helping us. And that was a teaching moment for the campaign. For a start, they realized, well, actually, the character of this guy is that not only does he stick to his guns, but we have a purpose, an identity in being different, in representing change, not just talking about change. And so, yeah, you know, it could have been better planned and better executed, but that became a rallying cry throughout the primaries. And he started quoting JFK, can't just talk to our friends, have to talk to our enemies. You know, as a matter of strength, he argued very strongly that you're not stronger by acting strong, you're stronger by having more allies. and dealing with these countries head on. So that was an important teaching moment and shaped his foreign policy moving forward.
On Obama's personal familiarity with Muslim culture, you write in the book that Obama confronted Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut during the campaign over Lieberman's half-hearted response to the rumors being planted that Obama was Muslim. What was that confrontation like?
Well, it was on the Senate floor. He pulled him over and said, listen, you got to stop doing this. I don't appreciate it. And by the way, remember that I helped you in the primaries, in the contested primaries that he was in. I went out there and campaigned, and it wasn't easy. And I took a lot of heat for it. And, you know, I know you're friends with John McCain, and you're going to be out there doing that, but don't do this kind of thing. And Lieberman denied it. I guess his office is still contests the idea that they were sort of half-hearted in beating down the Muslim rumors. But that was something Obama was convinced about, confronted him. And, you know, I don't know whether Lieberman changed his behavior, because he still went out there saying that Hamas supported Obama. I mean, he was way out there on a limb.
And what about Hillary Clinton? She famously said, when asked, Obama is not Muslim as far as I know.
Right. Well, it's not clear. There were lots of things said in that primary process. In fact, he confronted her, too, at an earlier stage, not about that, but about these arguments that, you know, he'd taken drink and drugs in his youth and that the Republicans would use that. There were Muslim emails that were sent around by her volunteers. And he confronted her on the tarmac. It's another scene I describe in the book. It became quite heated, what you call in diplomatic circles a frank exchange of views.
In New Hampshire during that primary?
This is actually in the confrontation happened in Washington at Reagan National Airport on their way to Iowa. The two planes were sitting side by side on the tarmac, and she called him over to have this exchange. And at the end of it, lots of gesticulation and finger pointing. He puts his hand on her to try to calm her down, and that only enrages her more. At the end of it, he goes back to his plane to a small group of aides and says, you know, I never saw that look of concern in her eyes before. I think we can win this one.
Huh. And yet you write that appointing Hillary Clinton Secretary of State was something he knew he wanted to do before the primaries were over.
That's right. He told me that in the Oval Office. I interviewed him, first print interview in the Oval Office. He said, you know, it was before the primaries over that he slotted her into this position, in at least in his own mind. And that was way before anyone around him. And I mean, people he trusted, consulted with, friends, you name it. They felt very bitterly and rancorous about the whole primary process. They were not ready to move on. He was thinking ahead. Now, that's not to say he didn't feel bitter about it, too. And it's certainly the case that the Clintons weren't over it at that point. In fact, in the transition, when they were actually really negotiating this job, one of his top members of staff said, don't worry, she's over the primaries. And Obama turned around and said, believe me, she's not over it yet.
Renegade, The Making of a President, the brand new book by Richard Wolff, who was on the show many times during the campaign as Newsweek correspondent, covering Obama, also many times on other things, covering the Bush administration and national politics in general. So how does Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, follow up now on the president's speech in Cairo? After his statement of broad principles and belief, this particular outreach that he did, how does she follow up with on-the-ground diplomacy?
Well, one thing is clear, both from recent presidents and from this president, is that you have to be engaged personally and continually at high, high levels. So she's going to have to do a lot of shuttle diplomacy. There's a lack of what they call partners for peace here. You've got Netanyahu's government on one side taking a very hard line and frankly, not even being willing to state the obvious that there's going to be a Palestinian state at some point. And then, of course, on the Palestinian side, this horribly weakened Palestinian authority and a strong Hamas in control of Gaza. But that's no reason to turn your back on it. And if presidents and administrations tune in late, as we saw with the Clintons and with President Bush most recently, there's no time. So what she has to do they've put a marker on the ground about settlements. I think that's going to be an important deliverable, as they like to say, for this administration to at least slow down and show that settlement growth, as a measure of good faith more than anything else, that the Israelis are serious about peace. They have to actually show something they can deliver on that side. And for the Palestinians, you know, rocket fire is always going to be a key test on what they can deliver, but they're also going to want to see some economic benefits and progress, at least in the West Bank. And again, that's going to have to come so that the Palestinians think that there's something moving.
All right. We have 2 minutes left. Real quick. The Yes We Can chant,
yes,
and slogan. You say it almost never got off the ground. What happened there?
The speech writers were looking for something for New Hampshire. They thought they were going to win that night. And one of them picked up a phrase in the debate in New Hampshire where Obama had said, look, you know, don't keep disheartening people about hope. One thing that makes this country great is when we say yes, we can. So it came up then, and one of the speechwriters turned to Jon Favreau, the young chief speechwriter, and said, hey, that's great, we should use that. And Favreau said, I'm not going to use it, I'm sorry. And they said, why not? He said, because I don't want people chanting yes, we can. And fortunately for him, they stuck with the line, and of course everybody ended up chanting yes, we can for the rest of the campaign.
Richard, you've come under some criticism yourself on Politico this week for some things surrounding this book, especially that if you had all this juicy stuff while you were covering the campaign for Newsweek, why didn't it show up in their magazine?
Well, Brian, you know something, it is standard practice for people to write books when they're at newspapers and magazines, and standard practice for people to save stuff in their books so that their books are actually worth buying. So it was a curious piece full of inaccuracies. It would take too long to deal with it now, but what I've done is not unusual.
And last thing, give me your take on the state of the Sotomayor nomination. It seems to me that after the brouhaha about one line in a speech she gave 8 years ago, the Republicans are now backing down big time from their initial harsh language about her. Senator John Cornyn of Texas distanced himself from the Newt Gingrich-Rush Limbaugh attacks, and Gingrich has even apologized for his initial outbursts about her character, and you don't see that every day.
No, you don't. And look, it was an excessive reaction. I mean, to start hurling around accusations of racism, especially from people who hate it when the other side throws out accusations of racism. I think they obviously realized that it wasn't working. It was alienating people. You know, if Newt Gingrich is serious about running for president, he's going to have to find a better sort of thermometer to judge the temperature. And you can't keep making mistakes and then claiming back your words. It's just not credible.
Richard Wolff, his new book, Renegade, The Making of a President. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.